neighbor, and the impact that the early Christian church had, the community of the church had. That changed with Constantine, and increasingly, all the way from Constantine through the colonial experiment, through the Middle Ages, it was really mission was expanded by the power of the state. Mission structures became married to state structures, as you guys know, and that continued right on through into almost 1800. 1792, William Carey came on the scene. Sorry, this thing feels backwards to me, so I always have to look to make sure I'm clicking it the right way, but anyway, I'll get it eventually. William Carey came on the scene, started China Inland Mission, wrote, I think it was 1792 when he wrote the On the Use of Means for the Conversion of Heathens, really a watershed life and book that really kind of established BMS. Oh, you're right. BMS, Baptist Mission Society. You're right. And later, we won't get into this, but later faith missions grew out of that. But really, William Carey introduced the idea of using mission societies or companies, as they were originally called. And that really unleashed a new wave of mission into the world. And really, the great century of mission was that century after William Carey. Some vehicles of mission then were actually the introduction of the steam engine and of electricity. Really, those technologies actually really facilitated mission. God used those technologies to grow and expand his church all over the world. At Edinburgh in 2010, people point to that as kind of a bit of a watershed moment where the local church began to kind of reawaken, and the role of the local church in mission was being reaffirmed more and more, starting with Edinburgh 2010. Of course, they just recently celebrated 2010. And they were looking at all the changes that have taken place since then. But I would argue that in many ways, we are in there's new technologies that have come on the scene that are reconfiguring mission and the way mission is done. And of course, today, it's bringing it even more back towards the local church, except that we're no longer in a local world. We're in what we call a glocal world. Raise your hand if you know it. Have you heard the term glocal before? Okay, most of us have, yeah. It's how the local community is connected globally, so it's glocal. We won't go into that any more than that. But the world has changed, but these technologies are making the world a smaller place, and Gene kind of talked about that some yesterday. And in many ways, these intermediaries are kind of weakening the role. These technologies are kind of weakening the role of the intermediary agency. This is happening for a number of different reasons. Wow, did I skip? No, here we go. Yeah. Let me introduce you to Cascadi Church. I grew up in the mountains, the foothills to the Andes in Venezuela and South America. For years, every Sunday, my family would get into this ancient Willie's Jeep because it had to have some four-wheel drive to make it over the roads up to this tiny little mountain town out in the middle of nowhere. You couldn't get to it if the rainy season there were too many landslides, but we wouldn't know that until we drove up there and couldn't go farther because there's no way to communicate with the outside world. I have great memories of that tiny little church. And now today they have a Facebook page, and it just blows me away. Absolutely blows me away. They just sent me an update the other day. They've got this new swimming pool that they put in at the church and a new basketball court, and there's pictures on Facebook, and it just kind of, it shows you how old I am, but it's amazing the changes that have taken place in my lifetime, right? Same story, actually, for my experience in Cambodia. And we were just talking about that this morning, but you know, when I started out in Cambodia in 2002, I was in the countryside, no running water, no electricity. We had a cell phone that, if you were really, really lucky, you could plug in these cords and connect it to your computer, and you could download the headings of emails, you know, to see if there was something really important that was worth trying to download the whole thing. And then about once a month, you'd go to the capital city, and there'd be real internet, and you could actually look at your email, you know. But I was a gatekeeper in that kind of a situation. I was a missionary, and there was never a foreigner from anywhere in the world in that town that I didn't know who they were, why they were there, how long they were there, what they were doing, and they weren't there for some reason connected to Food for the Hungry. That had radically changed within about 8 years, to where there were teams coming in from all over the world. I had no idea who they were. There were tourists coming through on bicycles, of all things. I mean, maybe biking across Cambodia sounds like a great idea when you're sitting in New Zealand, you know, internet cafe, but the reality is that's a crazy idea. Anyway, we won't go there. But, you know, the world has changed in a very short time, in a very rapid way. And I want to talk just a little bit about why these changes are taking place. We've already talked about them some. Just the rise of the internet and mobile communications, okay? As most of us probably know, people all over the world, especially pastors, they have smartphones with digital cameras that are hooked up. They can take a camera picture on their phone and upload it to Facebook in no time. They're tweeting. You know, so all of these technologies are spread all over the world. They're not a phenomenon here in England or the U.S. You know, people here still have landlines, you know, the old technology dial phones. You know, it's unheard of in most of the world because they've leapfrogged all that technology. And then secondly, it's also the rise of English as a global trade language. Jim talked about this, and it's something lamentable in many, many ways, but it's a reality, okay? English is there. It's spreading on the wings of globalization and on the internet. And so it's been entrenched kind of as a global trade language. You add to that quickening majority world growth. The fastest growing region in the world today is Africa, okay? The slowest is Europe, all right? Shrinking gap between nations, pastors, young people and congregations getting higher education than ever before. Certainly, if you want to be someone and go somewhere in today's world, whether you're in Africa or Cambodia, you learn English because you want to do business with the outside world. So people are becoming more globally aware and more confident in dealing with the outside world. And those trends, in turn, are really coinciding with the rise of global postmodernism. Now, we kind of tend to think of postmodernism as kind of a Western thing, and to some extent it is. But in fact, cities around the world, especially globally facing, externally oriented cities, postmodernism is really coming to the fore. Some of the emphasis of a postmodern culture, painting with a very broad brush again, okay, is community and relationship. There's a real value on being community-oriented, relationally-oriented. And there's actually, it changes the way people give to mission. They want more direct connection. They want more to be in touch personally with mission. People are no longer happy to give money into the offering plate and it goes off to the mission hierarchy of their denomination. They want a direct connection to people. And so community is really kind of a byword, a buzzword almost in a postmodern community. So you put these together, these cultural changes, these technological changes, and they're revolutionizing the way that missions is taking place. We can welcome it or not, but it's happening. It's absolutely happening. And really, they're chipping away at the centrality of this structure. You know, he who controls the remote controls the TV, right? All right? 15 years ago, mission societies had the remote controls. Okay? Today, missions is being democratized in a way it never has been before. And there's a lot of good and there's a lot of peril with that. Okay? But it's happening. Whereas in the past, there was always a gatekeeper organization between what was happening in England and America and what was happening in Uganda and in Cambodia and in Jakarta. Today, in fact, they're connecting directly with each other. And that central structure, that intermediary, that gatekeeper role is either being weakened or, in fact, disappearing altogether. Oops, I went one too far. Anyone remember this bit of British humor? Surely you do, right? Tell me, raise your hand if you know what this is. Okay, most of us do. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Anyone want to explain that to us? Or, you know? Okay, it's okay. Well, this is Monty Python, right? Good British humor. And the guy on your right is talking to the guy. You can't explain it, right? It's just pointless to explain when it's so good. I should put the clip on there. But he's asking him about sex, okay? Do you know what it's like to be with a lady? You know, does your lady like pictures? It's actually a bit lewd, right? It's British humor, okay? It's British humor. I need not explain more. But in fact, he, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, know what I mean, know what I mean? And I always appreciate it at a whole other level because it says, know what I mean, know what I mean? And he asks him knowingly. He throws the word no in there a lot, actually. And where does this come from, right? Even in British culture, American culture, increasingly post-Christian, to know in the biblical sense, right? People know what that means. They might not know anything else about the Bible, but they know what that means, right? It means to intimately know someone, to have sex with them, okay? And that's come across actually into popular culture, popular literature. Where did it come from? Well, it comes from the old King James translation of some passages in Genesis, the first one being Genesis 4:1, I think, where Adam knew Eve and they begot Cain, okay? So because of that, it's entered into popular culture. It's kind of this euphemism for sex, okay? But it points, actually, without Monty Python probably even knowing it, it points to a much deeper truth, okay? It's not altogether off to think of knowing as sex, but it's very incomplete. But what it does point to is the intimacy of knowing in Scripture, okay? In the Bible, knowing is not some Western academic abstract, you stand off and observe, you are detached from the situation, you look analytically and you make observation. No, knowing is a very vulnerable, actually, exercise, because knowing is giving of yourself. The intimacy, in fact, the union of sex within the covenant of marriage, it's actually a picture of how the knower and the known are intimately changed by knowing each other. What does the Bible say about man and wife? The two what? Shall become one flesh. Their identity is changed through knowing each other. And so the marriage covenant in the intimacy of marriage then is a picture of being changed and of knowing each other in that intimate way, in that actually vulnerable way. Now, like any metaphor, right, this can be taken way too far, but I'm actually going to try and connect the covenant of marriage and covenant more generally in Scripture to mission partnership. And I think it can be instructive for us, hopefully. So going forward then, when we talk about covenant and when we approach covenant and mission relationship, we're talking about the unifying nature, okay, the fundamental change that we undergo when we know our partner, okay, in the full biblical sense of that word. Let me pull this over here. I've never tried this before, so we'll see how this goes, okay? This could very well backfire, I have no idea. But I want to do some word association. Some word association here. I want to do some word association here, and we'll see how this goes. First, let's put up the word kingdom. Okay? So, kingdom. I want from you. Spur of the moment thinking, what are some words you associate? One word, short little phrase that you associate with kingdom. What first comes to mind? Power. Jim? Rule. I'm sorry?
People.
Whew. Sorry. Subjects.
Control.
The Queen.
You Brit. Masculinity. Okay. Very good. King. And we're going to go ahead and stop there, okay? But let's try, again, the very same thing. What are the first thoughts, phrases, words that come to mind when you think of covenant?
Creator.
I'm sorry?
Agreement.
Agreement. What else? Contract. Anything else?
Promise.
What else? I missed both of those, sorry. Relationship?
Mutual.
Lawyers.
That's very English. Very
lawyers.
Absolutely. A very legitimate first word to come to mind. Yes. Anything else? Finding? Binding. Commitment. Okay, we'll put binding commitment and we'll call it good. And apologize, I don't have spell check on the whiteboard, so there's probably something up there wrong. Okay. You know, so you can see there's some difference in our first momentary everyday impressions of these two words. Where does that come from? And actually, I think our everyday impressions for most of us are pretty different, right? Kingdom and covenant have some very different ideas come to mind. But it's interesting that they are so different, particularly because, you know, things like power, control, masculinity, those come to mind much more with kingdom, whereas covenant is much more about promise, mutual, relationship, commitment, with lawyers thrown in. Okay. Why are these actually so different? You know, and it's interesting that they're so different because if you think about covenant in the Bible, covenant, the primary central covenants in Scripture between God and man, it doesn't get a whole lot more equal than that. It doesn't get a whole lot more disparities in power than that. And yet, somehow we conceive of covenant as a promise, as mutual, as relationship. That's actually radical when you think about it. Amazing. And what's radical and amazing about it is that covenant, this our today, 4,000 years later, we still see covenant fundamentally different than kingdom because of the central innovation, if you will, of God's covenant with the Hebrews, of Yahweh's covenant with the Hebrews. It points back to that central difference of the way Hebrews used covenant and their ancient Near East neighbors did. Because everyone in the ancient Near East used it. It's a very, very common thing that continues today. Covenants are all over English law, and in a very different way, they're all over Africa and South America and Asia as well. But actually, the difference is that God, Yahweh, became a partner in the covenant agreement with his people. He, instead of just being a deity who was invoked to enforce the covenant, he came in and became a part of that covenant. And so what that did is it equalized on the other side of the covenant, the people of Israel, actually kind of a radical egalitarian social model emerged because of the covenant, because there was God on one side and all the people collectively on the other, all the Jews on the other. So they're equalized in their status before God as the covenant community. So they handled power very, very differently in ancient Israel than they did in the ancient, their ancient Near East neighbors. And think about Jesus himself. Think about the new covenant. Okay, the new covenant meal, actually. What does Jesus do before the meal? What's the thing that he does right before the meal? He washes their feet, right? Obviously, Jesus is using that not simply to clean their feet, but he's making the point of, I use power very differently. Okay, under the new covenant, power is going to be very different. And in fact, is it Paul? Sorry, I can't remember. Where is it that it says, knowing all things have been given? Is that John? Thank you. All authority in heaven and earth has been given me. Okay? And with that as the background, then he washes the disciples' feet. And then it's Paul, right? Paul acknowledges that there's inequality in the marriage relationship. But what does he say about husbands? Husbands what? Love your wives. So inside of the covenant of marriage, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. So this concept of covenant, not just in the Old Testament, but in the New Covenant, and in covenants between people, can really help us to shape our thinking when we think about mission partnership. Particularly, mission partnership going forward, in which it's local to local, end to end, church to church, congregation to congregation, Christian to Christian, with a diminished role in the middle for the gatekeeper. The problem, I think, and this is my opinion, this is probably why, I'm here today, I don't think we think in terms of covenant enough. If you do a Google search for kingdom partnership, all right, and then you do a Google search for covenant partnership, I've done it two times, and I've come up approximately 60 times as many hits for kingdom partnership as for covenant partnership. Okay? Kingdom is central. Don't get me wrong, but so is covenant. In fact, Scripture says that when God wants to build his kingdom, what does he do? He enters a covenant relationship, starting with Abraham, starting with Noah. He entered a covenant. Isaiah says he entered a covenant relationship with himself. He pledged to send Jesus, incarnate Son. And when he starts the redemption story, it starts with the covenant with Abraham and extends through Christ into the new covenant. So I guess my plea is that we start to think more in terms of covenant. Now, I want to be a little bit more specific going forward. There are some ways that covenant can actually help us think about partnership and mission. Can everyone see that, or is this blocking? Maybe I'm going to move this. So, covenant partnership can help us think in more vulnerable ways. Okay, it can move us towards vulnerable mission. Now, I am not under any particular illusion that this local-to-local, congregation-to-congregation is going to become a pure vulnerable exercise in mission anytime soon. But we live in the real world, and we have to deal with the real world as it is. And so if we look at local-to-local mission, and we look at the two pillars, really, of vulnerable mission, which are what? Doing mission with local resources and using local languages. That doesn't look real good compared to local mission, right? How often are they using local languages? Well, like, never. How often are they using local resources? Perhaps a tiny bit more, but pretty much never. So when we think about resources, when we think about language, we also need to think about other aspects of mission partnership: faithfulness or security in partnership, accountability in partnership, and sharing people in partnership. All of those things, covenant has a lot to say about those things. And so I want to take a few minutes to walk through that with you guys. But first, are there questions or comments, snide comments at this point? Yeah, Jim. Excellent. Yeah, excellent, excellent question. And the answer is you have to wait and see. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think covenant does help us reorient and think differently than the status quo about accountability. I will say that for sure. Anything else? Or shall we go forward? Okay, so looking at resources and partnership. Again, stopping to ask how covenant can help inform how we think about resources and partnership. You can probably see where I'm going with this one. But gift-giving actually is a central part of the covenant ceremony, and it actually features prominently. And if you look in the biblical record, very clear that exchange of gifts is a part of the covenant ceremony and of the covenant relationship. But it's a symbol of how each partner, and again, this is also true within the marriage covenant, actually gives themselves to the other, okay, in this mutuality. What was the term you used for covenant? Mutual. There's a mutuality, chesed, if you want to get back to some of the Hebrew in covenant. You know, I once showed up, I had a number of Korean friends from Cambodia, and you'd think I would be smarter than this, but I showed up at a Korean friend's house with no gift. So stupid of me. But I did it, you know. She invited us over for dinner, and I went and I had no gift, and I felt stupid about it, and then I admired her potted plant a little too overtly, and she gave it to me. I was like, duh, you know. We are just so bad about gift giving in the West. We just don't do it. We don't get it. And it's actually really a pity. It really is a pity. But I fall into the same trap myself. As Gene can testify, anytime you go to especially any rural house in Cambodia, the first thing they do is they send someone up the coconut tree to get you some fresh tak dong, which is the coconut milk. And they give you this as a gift. It's just a standard feature of Cambodian hospitality. You know, in Africa, it's replete. Gift giving is replete. You know, marriage in many, many, many cultures, tribes in Africa, marriage is very much a covenant kind of a ceremony, and it involves gift exchange between the families of the bride and the groom. And like I've already said, you know, we in North America and Eurasian cultures definitely outdone. And the way we even approach it is differently. Now, I used to get so embarrassed. I still do a little bit. It's so still a little bit foreign. But, you know, Cambodians would come in and give me a gift and, oh, I worked so hard for this. I spent 2 weeks of my salary. I couldn't find it. The shops are closed. So I went all the way across town to get you this gift. And I'm like, oh. Thank you. And I'm just, you know, at first you just don't know quite how to react. Because what do? Oh, here's something, but it's nothing, really. It's nothing. I you know, just a little trinket, you know. That's an insult in Cambodia and much of the world. No, a gift, the value that you place on the gift is a direct reflection of the value you place on the friendship. You place on the person who's receiving the gift. So what do? You talk a gift up. You don't talk your gift down. You talk it up. Because you're valuing this person and you want them to feel valued. Say, wow, they spent that much on me? They did that much trouble for me? They must really love me. And it's a beautiful thing if you can get used to it, but it takes some getting used to. Okay? So a valuable gift, in other words, then, is it reflects the high value that they place on the friendship and the friend. Now, in the context of this, what I talk about, congregation to congregation, local to local mission, what can we think about gift giving, about this mutual exchange that's such a prominent feature of covenant? Any assistance given by one partner to the other then has to be a gift, first of all, and it has to be mutual. It has to be an exchange, okay? Premature giving also in a local-to-local partnership. And what is that like? Well, you know what it's like? It's like premarital sex. Statistically, probably a lot of you know, what do statistics say about people who cohabitate and then go on to get married? What is the likelihood of their marriage lasting? It's very significantly lower than those who don't. Okay? What does this say about gift-giving outside of a covenant relationship and mission? All right, you are hurting the intimacy of that relationship. You are doing permanent, long-term damage to that relationship. Now, we don't know it, right? Because we don't know what the alternative is. We don't see the damage because it's already done, and we don't know what we're missing. And so we kind of tend to downplay the damage, but actually it's real and it's permanent. Only within a pre-existing covenant relationship can any sort of a financial gift be exercised. Maybe it's like financial consummation, right? When you've earned the right. And it is mutual. It is a gift, i.e. no strings attached. It's a gift. And it's part of a mutual covenantal exchange. When sex isn't mutual, what's it called? It's called rape. Okay? When you dump a financial gift, quote unquote, on a partner that cannot be reciprocated, it's like financial rape. You are doing damage to the identity of your covenant partner. And you don't do that in a covenant relationship. So like sex, giving must be reciprocal. Okay? Both partners give and both receive. Otherwise, like we said, sex becomes rape. It's distorted. And now, there's this mutuality, this equality that must be adhered to within a covenant relationship. Okay? What are some of the gifts that the Western Church can receive? I just want your ideas. What are some of the gifts that we in the North, that we in the West could receive from our global Southern partners, from the Church in the global South? Doesn't have to be a physical gift. In fact, physical gifts are usually the most non-transformative gift that there is. I'm sorry? Sure. Or when they come here, yeah. Yeah, Jim. Service and hospitality, right? Not exactly Western values. We could learn a lot. A lot. I love reading through the Old Testament and seeing the instances of hospitality with Abraham, even with Lot. It's amazing, and it reminds me so much of Cambodia. It makes me a little, I'd say, homesick. I don't know if Cambodia's my home anymore, but anyway, friendship, commitment to family, community. Yeah. That really is kind of over and against the extreme individualism. What are all these things? Friendship, hospitality, commitment to community, family. Those are covenant values. Those are covenantal values deeply embedded in covenant. There's so much that we can learn. And why? Because despite the fact that we have covenants in British law with lawyers to enforce them, covenant is no longer really a part of our culture. So much that we can learn. Probably the greatest gift, which has really moved me anyway, is seeing our values reflected back to us by interacting and intimately knowing others from outside our value system. That is a truly transformative gift. But we can't receive that gift if we're not in a covenant relationship. If we're not open to being known and to knowing intimately, and knowing that our fundamental identity is going to be changed by this, we'll never receive that gift. We have to be open to it. Okay, moving on here. When does this session end, Jim? I'm sorry, I should pay attention to the clock more. Does anyone have on there? It's 10:30 right now. How much time do I have left? Okay. All right, moving right along. Okay. When I was starting research for, I'm doing a PhD very slowly, painfully, circuitously. Eventually it might come out the other end. starting the project, I was doing some research into covenant and church twining, or local to local church twining, it's often called, in Catholic, even in maybe Anglican circles. And I found this book. I was really excited to get it. It talked about church twining, and it talked about covenant a couple times in the book. I was really excited to do it. I went to the library, got this book shipped in, looked at it. At the end, it has this covenant that they suggest signing between churches in the global South and the global North. And the whole book is kind of a nuts and bolts guide to doing church twining, they called it. Okay, this covenant was 7 dense pages of lawyerly, archaic English that I could sort of understand, but the suggestion that a non-native English speaker, that this is a covenant relationship that they sign, that is written verbal abuse if there ever was, absolute abuse. To suggest that that is a covenant. Anyway, yeah, it's not. Okay, it's not. Covenants in Scripture are oral agreements. There's different ways that they're agreed. There's different signs and symbols and ceremony around them. But they're an oral agreement. And what did Jesus say? When it comes to our promises, what did Jesus say? Let your yes be yes and your no be no, and verify it with a team of lawyers. No, okay. So we need to first of all recognize that our global southern partners are much, much, much closer to the biblical record and to Jesus' instructions than we are. Okay, we come from, I'm an American, or I have an American passport. Yeah, I'm an American. And, you know, we have more lawyers per capita, I think, than any other nation in the world. And England's probably not too far behind. We come from cultures where any, you know, legal minutia loophole will be exploited to our great advantage or disadvantage. And so we draw things up in lawyerly language. We cover our posteriors very carefully. And we have that same attitude sometimes when we go to the majority world. We say, oh, well, you know, I've had partners of my organization in Cambodia say, oh, well, you know, yeah, we'll commit to one visit, we'll commit to 1 year. And this is after a week of conferencing with them. And I can just see the eyes of my colleagues, my Cambodian colleagues, just going wide. Like, what? 1 year? One visit? Now, I know they're covering themselves. They're saying, I can't commit because, you know, something could happen. The sky, all of our funding could dry up. Our churches could stop sending people. This could happen. But, okay, what is this? It protects us, right? It protects us and it exposes our partner. And so they wonder, their eyes open wide, and they wonder, why are they communicating with so little trust? Why are they communicating with so little value of this relationship that they would say that? And so what do they do? Well, they respond with equal distrust, with equal guardedness, okay? And that very lack of security that they feel, then they respond in equal measure to that. All right, moving on. Sorry, that was a paper. Hit that. Whew. Never knew paper was that strong. Okay. Faithfulness and partnership. I think we already talked about some church that was sending 60 teams. Yeah, I was at a conference, a missions conference in Phoenix this last year, or this year anyway, recently. Phoenix, Arizona. And it was graciously hosted by a huge church, this massive, massive facility, multiple buildings, a massive campus. You know, Phoenix has lots of room, nothing but desert to build on, so they had huge facility. And at various points around their facility, around their campus, they had huge wall maps and posters and whatnot of all the places that they had gone on short-term trips the previous year and where they were heading the next year. And every continent save Antarctica was covered. Everywhere they were sending people. But actually, from what I could see on the map, there was no discernible connection to where they'd been last year and where they were going this next year. No overlap whatsoever. You know, it reminded me actually of how the ancient Near East peoples, Israel's neighbors, were. They were spiritual polygamists, or maybe more like spiritual prostitutes. Okay, they had many, many pagan deities that they invoked for every need, every occasion, flipping their loyalties here and there overnight to meet their needs. And contrast that, then, with Hebrew covenant. Hebrew covenant was the bedrock of Israel's monotheism. Okay, God is a jealous God. I am one God. You will worship no other God but me. You will have no other. You will make no idols. You will keep my name. You will not use my name in vain. The covenant then was really Israel's commitment to one God and God's commitment to the one people of Israel. So there's great faithfulness and great security in the covenant relationship. And again, the marriage relationship is intended to be an expression and a model of that. While it's extremely vulnerable, a marriage is extremely vulnerable, it is also very secure. So, you know, when we think about covenant and we think about local to local, You know, a Western, I'm sorry, but it's, I think it's true. A Western church partner who engages in mission all over the world, everywhere. This year here, next year there, short projects, teachings, other engagements with all kinds of different partners. What does that look like? What does that look like when we think of the marriage covenant? Yeah, extremely unfaithful. Okay. It's like a bunch of one-night stands all over the world. And it's very, very much in contrast to God's very stubborn insistence in the face of Israel's infidelity, I will not abandon you. I will save a remnant. Even though he's in pain, he limits himself to his mission through his covenant bride. Okay. Moving on. Accountability, back to what Jim was saying. The flip side to security and to faithfulness, the flip side of that is accountability. Okay. This is kind of reflected in the law and grace debate about the covenants. I'm going to skip that part, actually. Yeah, okay, well, all right. Law is kind of reflected right then in the accountability, and grace reflected in the security. And so Old Testament theologians, and they debate endlessly still today, you know, are the covenants of Abraham and of Israel with God, are those unconditional and unilateral? In other words, are they acts of grace? Or, in fact, are the covenants of Israel to their God, are those conditional on Abraham's obedience, on Israel's obedience? Are they, in fact, acts of law? But I think probably the answer is really both. The grace side of the covenant is, look, what we just talked about, right? It's God refusing to abandon his covenant partner Israel in spite of their unfaithfulness. He will not abandon his people. He will not be unfaithful to the covenants that he has made. And yet, there is clearly accountability in there. I mean, it's clear that Israel is accountable to God as their pain throughout their history has shown when they are unfaithful to the covenant. But what I want to focus on isn't Israel's accountability to God, it's God's accountability to Israel. And this is really amazing, okay? Yahweh himself choosing, appropriating covenant to make himself accountable to Israel. How does he do this? Well, okay, in Genesis, what is it, Genesis 15, in Genesis 15, Abraham meets up with God, and they do a covenant ceremony together, okay? It starts off with Abraham requesting God, God, I need a sign. How do I know that you're going to be faithful to your promise, okay? Pretty bold. Abraham's bold on a number of occasions, right? But pretty bold of Abraham to go to God and make that request, especially when the whole dialogue starts with God saying, do not be afraid, Abraham, right? So Abraham then turns around and says, God, how do I know you're going to be, how do I know you're going to be true to your promise? How are you going to be accountable to what you've said, okay? And what's amazing is that God just doesn't like meet Abraham halfway. He goes all the way as far as he can to reassure Abraham. God appropriates, again, the ancient Near East practices, the symbols around the covenant ceremony, cuts animals in half and lays them out, and in a clay pot, fiery pot, God passes through the animals. And in doing so, very well understood that he says, as it happened to these animals, may it be done to me. As to these animals, may it be done to me if I do not fulfill my covenant obligations. And then he swears by the highest authority that he knows, which is himself. Okay? Yahweh swears by himself as the one true God. In the ancient Near East, they swore by all of their deities. God, being the one true God, he swears by himself that he will hold himself to his promises. So this whole ceremony is intended to convey to Abraham, the weaker party, the party who was trembling in fear when it started. It's intended to convey to him, listen, I, Yahweh, will be faithful to my promise. I've told you what I'm going to do. I've told you the extent of the land you're going to possess. I've even told you that your people are going to be exiled in Egypt for 400 years. And I've sworn by the highest authority that I know, I've sworn by the most powerful symbols that you understand, that I will be faithful to my promise to you. So rest assured, I'm holding myself accountable to our agreement. Now, in any other ancient Near East culture, Abraham would then have passed through the cut animals. God never asks him to. He doesn't ask Abraham to meet him halfway. God goes all the way. He says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to hold myself accountable to you. I'm not worried about you at the moment. You need reassurance from me. Here it is. Here it is. Amazing. This is God we're talking about. And he chooses covenant to hold himself accountable to do what he will do to Abraham, the weaker partner. Fascinating. And it, again, it's a very broad picture, but it certainly points in a different direction than how accountability usually happens, doesn't it? Okay, last point here, since we are 2 minutes from time. When we are on home leave or living in America, we have parents, grandparents of my children in the Midwest and family up and down the East Coast. And then we have other family on the West Coast. And one family is, in fact, a lot more fun for children to hang around than the other. You know, one grandma just completely spoils them, absolutely rotten, and drives mother and father a little crazy because we have to deal with a mess afterwards. But kids love it. Kids love it, you know. The other grandmother is a lovely lady, but she's kind of the, you know, push the birds out of the nest when they might be able to fly kind of a grandma. So she, you know, gives them a little bit of loving, might read a story to them, and then goes into her room with her dog and reads her own books, you know, and the kids are like, ugh. But we visit both, okay? We visit both. You don't, when you enter into a marriage relationship, two extended families are getting married, and you spend time with both. You spend time with both. We make sure to visit both sides, even though one might be objectively more fun. Now imagine for a moment a young family who, not because one grandma or grandpa is more fun than the other, but they go to visit one grandma because she's got a really cool yard with interesting plants and lots of really funky neighbors. Okay, and they spend all their time visiting that grandma. You know where I'm going with this, right? Think about a northern church that sends lots of short-term teams to, even if they have a covenant partner, even if they're not sending them all over the world, even if they've chosen three people that they want to engage deeply and be changed by, they send all their people over there every year. They're sending one team or two teams, and it's never reciprocated. How mutual is that? What kind of an exchange is that? Again, it has to be a gift, and it has to be mutual. It has to be an exchange. You know, even a missionary, a long-term missionary, really, that should be going as a part of a gift, signifying what could be more valuable than sending one of your own long-term to your covenant partner. One of the ways of sharing people that was very common was sharing a meal, absolutely integral to the Hebrews and the people in the ancient Near East, and today all over the world, is eating a meal together. In fact, ancient Near East records show that kings, if they were afraid that their subjects were going to sign covenants with others, they forbid them from eating meals together with other people as a way of trying to maintain their loyalty. Because to eat a meal was to enter into relationship, and that's certainly true in the majority world today in many cultures. In Cambodia, my colleagues would often tell me that of all the humiliations under the Khmer Rouge, and we won't get into what the Khmer Rouge was, but of all the incredible humiliations and deprivations and death and starvation, the thing that they hated the most was having to eat together out of a common pot with complete strangers. They despised it, because eating a meal is an act of intimacy. Around the Last Supper, then, at the New Covenant, Jesus and his friends entered into a new covenant relationship around a meal, which of course today we memorialize in the Eucharist. So this covenant meal, actually the covenant ceremony, we won't go into the whole covenant ceremony, but there's actually a formula of how the covenant works. It begins with a preamble and moves into a historical prologue. The preamble It's not just some formality, but it's actually a voluntary self-disclosure of each partner to the other. This is who I am. This is what makes me tick. I want you to know me. Here's who I am. And in the historical prologue is a recitation, a recital of all that God has done to bring the partners to this point. All that God has done in the past to make this meal, this relationship possible. It's kind of like Moses reciting all that God had done to take his people out of Egypt and into the promised land during the covenant ceremonies at Sinai and the covenant ceremony at Moab. And really, this is best done over a meal. Again, eating a meal is something that we also tend to neglect in our kind of pragmatic, busy, fast cultures in the West. But a meal allows us a chance to sit down, to slow down, to share, to exchange with each other, and to recite together all the goodness of God in bringing us together and making this relationship possible. So, the Great Commission is actually a very covenantal text. We don't often think of this, but okay. It's a condensed covenant. The parts of the covenant ceremony are the preamble, the historical prologue, which we already talked about. Then the covenant stipulation is kind of the body of it. And it ends by invoking witnesses and then gives promises and or curses for faithfulness or unfaithfulness to the covenant. So look at the Great Commission. Look at how that fits into the new covenant. It's really a covenantal statement that Jesus made under the new covenant to us. So I'm just going to leave it there. But I think something's a little out of balance in my mind if we Google kingdom partnership and come up with 60 times more results than covenant partnership. The Bible shows that when God wants to grow his kingdom, when he wants to do his mission, he does it through covenant relationships. So I think we'd be extremely foolish to throw out this model, particularly when it's a model that fits so well with so many of our covenant partners, our mission fields, in a sense, when it helps us to move towards them in a vulnerable fashion, and it's so consistent with how God works in the world. Okay, I guess time's pretty much up, so questions, sorry, later, ask me. We can talk.